网天下，北京外语广播。
Your bilingual station, AM 774。
大学生英语在线，你想知道的问题，你告诉他；你没想到的问题，他告诉你。最顶尖的英语专家，最有效的学习方法，雅思托福 GRE 轻松得分没问题。 Question of the day， 大学生英语在线，每天上午6:30，晚上11:00，与您准时相约。
大家好，这里是北京外语广播正在播出的大学生英语在线 Question of the day， 我是 Larry， 欢迎大家加入我们的互动 QQ 群33176400，下载最新的英语学习资料。每到周末我们都会聊一聊 TED Talk， 希望对大家的雅思和托福考试有所帮助。今天我们请来的嘉宾老师是壮壮老师，老师好。
Hello everybody。Before we start our TED Talk, I'd like to ask you, Larry, the question of what is the earliest computer that you have had? How it looks like?
The first computer I used was the one I bought when I was a primary school student. It was a very heavy one with fewer functions than today's computer.And it ran really slowly because the configuration of this computer is not so satisfactory compared to today's computers.
Okay, do you still recall the operating system this computer had?
Yeah, I still remember that. That was Windows 95.
Okay, so mine was even older than yours. The first one that I had the DOS system with a black screen and white letters.Appearing on the computer screen.
啊，壮壮老师之前用的是 DOS 系统的电脑。
没错。
也就是基本没有操作界面，只是输入指令，然后它弹出来一个指令。
一个玩意儿。对，所以那个就更早的。今天我们听的这个话题呢，也是关于电脑的。The topic, title is The Birth of the Computer by technician historian or technology historian George Deason.Who tells stories from the birth of the modern computer, from its 17th century origins to the hilarious notebooks of some early computer engineers. 放之前我就提醒大家有一个词儿注意，就是 hilarious, H-I-L-A-R-I-O-U-S. Hilarious 这个词呢，就是搞笑的，令人捧腹的。这样呢就是比较逗的这种形容词，一般大家想起来说哎呦这事不是好好笑啊，就想第一反应你觉得 Larry 要是不经过 hilarious 的特意提醒你会用什么词啊？
humorous
不错。
funny，
然后呢
funny
对，然后一般大家也就想到这两个词，但是其实呢英文说的比较频率高的就是 hilarious，所以呢希望大家可以多多去用啊。在介绍的时候我们刚才就提到过了，说 hilarious notebooks of some early computer engineers， 也就是早期的这个电脑工程师们他们所使用的笔记本电脑，就是挺逗的挺搞笑的。 So let's take a listen.
Last year I told you the story in 7 minutes of Project Orion, which was this very implausible technology that you know technically it could have worked, but it had this sort of 1 year political window where it could have happened. So it didn't happen. It was a dream that did not happen. This year, I'm going to tell you the story of the birth of digital computing. This was a perfect introduction. And it's a story that did work. It did happen, and the machines are all around us. And it was a technology that was inevitable. If the people I'm going to tell you the story about, if they hadn't done it, somebody else would have. So it was sort of the right idea at the right time.This is Barrichelli's universe. This is the universe we live in now. It's the universe in which these machines are now doing all these things, including changing biology. I'm starting a story with you at the first atomic bomb at Trinity, which was the Manhattan Project. It was a little bit like TED. It brought a whole lot of very smart people together. And three of the smartest people were Stan Ulam, Richard Feynman, and John von Neumann. And it was von Neumann who said, after the bomb, he was working on something much more important than bombs. He's thinking about computers. So he wasn't only thinking about them, he built one. This is the machine he built. He built this machine, and we had a beautiful demonstration of how this thing really works with these little bits. And it's an idea that goes way back. The first person to really explain that was Thomas Hobbes, who in 1651 explained how arithmetic and logic are the same thing. And if you want to do artificial thinking and artificial logic, you can do it all with arithmetic. He said you needed addition and subtraction. Leibniz, who came a little bit later, this is 1679, showed that you didn't even need subtraction. You can do the whole thing with addition. Here we have all of the binary arithmetic and logic that drove the computer revolution. And Leibniz was the first person to really talk about building such a machine. He talked about doing it with marbles, having gates and what we now call shift registers, where you shift the gates and drop the marbles down the tracks. And that's what all these machines are doing, except instead of doing it with marbles, they're doing it with electrons. And then we jump to von Neumann, 1945, when he sort of reinvents the whole same thing. And 1945, after the war, the electronics existed to actually try and build such a machine. So June 1945, right, actually the bomb hasn't even been dropped yet, and von Neumann is putting together all the theory to actually build this thing, which also goes back to Turing, who before that gave the idea that you could do all this with a very brainless little finite state machine, just reading a tape in and reading a tape out. The other sort of genesis of what von Neumann did was the difficulty of how you would predict the weather. Lewis Richardson saw how you could do this with a cellular array of people, giving them each a little chunk and putting it together. Here we have an electrical model illustrating a mind having a will, but capable of only two ideas. And this is really the simplest computer. So it's basically, why you need the qubit, because it only has two ideas. And you put lots of those together, you get the essentials of the modern computer. The arithmetic unit, the central control, the memory, the recording medium, the input and the output. But there's one catch. This is the fatal, we saw it in the starting these programs up. The instructions which govern this operation must be given in absolutely exhaustive detail. So the programming has to be perfect or it won't work. If you look at the origins of this, the classic history sort of takes it all back to the ENIAC here, but actually the machine I'm going to tell you about, the Institute for Advanced Study Machine, which is way up there, really should be down there. So I'm trying to revise history and give some of these guys more credit than they've had. Such a computer would open up universes which are at the present outside the range of any instrument. So it opens up a whole new world, and these people saw it. The guy who was supposed to build this machine was the guy in the middle, of Vladimir Zvorkin from RCA. RCA, and probably one of the lousiest business decisions of all time, decided not to go into computers. But the first meetings, November 1945, were at RCA's offices. RCA started this whole thing off and said, television's the future, not computers. The essentials were all there, all the things that make these machines run. Von Neumann and a logician and a mathematician from the army put this together. Then they needed a place to build it. When RCA said no, that's when they decided to build it in Princeton, where Freeman works at the Institute. That's where I grew up as a kid. That's me. That's my sister Esther, who's talked to you before. So we both go back to the birth of this thing. That's Freeman a long time ago. And that was me. And this is von Neumann and Morgenstern, who wrote the theory of games. All these forces came together there in Princeton. Oppenheimer, who had built the bomb. The machine was actually used mainly for doing bomb calculations. And Julian Bigelow, who took Zvorkin's place as the engineer to actually figure out, using electronics, how you would build this thing. The whole gang of people who came to work on this, and the women in front who actually did most of the coding, were the first programmers. These were the prototype geeks, the nerds. They didn't fit in at the Institute. This is a letter from the director, concerned about, especially unfair in the matter of sugar. You can read the text. So, this is hackers getting in trouble for the first time. So, these were not theoretical physicists. They were real soldering gun type guys. And they actually built this thing. And we take it for granted now that each of these machines has billions of transistors doing billions of cycles per second without failing. They were using vacuum tubes. It was very narrow, sloppy techniques to get actually binary behavior out of these radio vacuum tubes. Yeah, they actually used 6J6, the common radio tube, because they found they were more reliable than the more expensive tubes. And what they did at the Institute was publish every step of the way. Reports were issued so that this machine was cloned at 15 other places around the world. And it was the original microprocessor. All the computers now are copies of that machine. The memory was in cathode ray tubes, a whole bunch of spots on the face of the tube, very, very sensitive to electromagnetic disturbances. So there's 40 of these tubes, like a V40 engine running the memory. The input and the output was by teletype tape at first. This is a wire drive using bicycle wheels. This is the archetype of the hard disk that's in your machine now. Then they switch to a magnetic drum. This is modifying IBM equipment, which is the origins of the whole data processing industry later at IBM. And this is the beginning of computer graphics, the graphic beam turn on this next slide. That's, as far as I know, the first digital bitmap display, 1954. So, but Neumann was already off in the theoretical cloud doing abstract sort of studies of how you could build reliable machines out of unreliable components. Those guys drinking all the tea with sugar in it were writing in their logbooks trying to get this thing to work with all these 2,600 vacuum tubes that failed half the time. And that's what I've been doing this last 6 months, is going through the logs. Running time, 2 minutes. Input-output, 90 minutes. This includes a large amount of human error. So they're always trying to figure out what's machine error, what's human error, what's code, what's hardware. That's an engineer gazing at tube number 36 trying to figure out why the memory's not in focus. He had to focus the memory. Seems okay. So he had to focus each tube just to get the memory up and running, let alone having, you know, software problems. No use, went home. Impossible to follow the damn thing. Where's the directory? So already they're complaining about the manuals. Before closing down in disgust, the general arithmetic, the operating logs, burning lots of midnight oil. MANIAC, which became the acronym for machine, mathematical, numerical, integrator, and calculator, lost its memory. MANIAC regained its memory when the power went off. Machine or human? Aha! So figure out it's a code problem. Found trouble in code, I hope. Code error, machine not guilty. Damn it, I can be just as stubborn as this thing. And the dawn came. So they ran all night, 24 hours a day, this thing was running, mainly running bomb calculations. Everything up to this point is wasted time. What's the use? Good night. Master control off. The hell with it. Way off. Something's wrong with the air conditioner. Smell of burning V-belts in the air. A short, do not turn the machine on. IBM machine putting a tar-like substance on the cars. The tar is from the roof, so they really were working under tough conditions. Here, a mouse has climbed into the blower behind the regulator rack, set blower to vibrating, result, no more mouse. Here lies mouse born, died 4:50 a.m. May 1953. There's an inside joke. Someone has penciled in, here lies Marston mouse. If you're a mathematician, you get that, because Marston was a mathematician who objected to the computer being there. Picked the lightning bug off the drum. Running at 2 kilocycles. That's 2,000 cycles per second. Yes, I'm chicken. So 2 kilocycles was slow speed. The high speed was 16 kilocycles. I mean, if you remember a Mac that was 16 megahertz, that's slow speed. I have now duplicated both results. How will I know which is right, assuming one result is correct? This now is the third different output. I know when I'm licked. We've duplicated errors before. Machine runs fine, code isn't. Only happens when the machine is running. And sometimes things are okay. Machine, a thing of beauty and a joy forever. Perfect running. Parting thought, when there's bigger and better errors, we'll have them. So nobody was supposed to know they were actually designing bombs. They were designing hydrogen bombs. But someone in the logbook late one night finally drew a bomb. So that was the result. It was Mike, the first thermonuclear bomb in 1952. That was designed on that machine in the woods behind the Institute. So But Neumann invited a whole gang of weirdos from all over the world to work on all these problems. Baricelli, he came to do what we now call really artificial life, trying to see if in this artificial universe, I mean, he was a viral geneticist way ahead of his time. He's still ahead of some of the stuff that's being done now, trying to start an artificial genetic system running in the computer. Began, his universe started March 3rd, 53, so it's almost exact, it's 50 years ago next Tuesday, I guess. And he saw everything in terms of, he could read the binary code straight off the machine. He had a wonderful rapport. Other people couldn't get the machine running. He always worked for him. Even errors were duplicated. Dr. Baricelli claims machine is wrong, code is right. So he designed this universe and ran it. When the bomb people went home, he was allowed in there, and he would run that thing all night long, running these things. If anybody remembers Stephen Wolfram, who reinvented this stuff. And he published it. It wasn't locked up and disappeared. It was published in the literature. If it's that easy to create living organisms, why not create a few yourself? So he decided to give it a try, to start this artificial biology going in the machines. And he found all these, he sort of was like a naturalist coming in and looking at this tiny 5,000 byte universe and seeing all these things happening that we see in the outside world in biology. Those are some of his generations of his universe. But they're just going to stay numbers. They're not going to become organisms. They have to have something. You have a genotype and you have to have a phenotype. They have to go out and do something. And he started doing that. Started giving these little numerical organisms things they could play with, playing chess with other machines and so on. And they did start to evolve. And he went around the country after that. Every time there was a new fast machine, he started using it. And saw exactly what's happening now. That the programs, instead of being turned off when you quit the program, you'd keep running, and basically all the sort of things like a Windows is doing, running as a multicellular organism on many machines, he envisioned all that happening. And he saw that evolution itself was an intelligent process. There wasn't any sort of creator intelligence, but the thing itself was a giant parallel computation that would have some intelligence. And he went out of his way to say he was not saying this was lifelike, or a new kind of life, it just was another version of the same thing happening. And there's really no difference between what he was doing in the computer and what nature did billions of years ago. And could you do it again now? So when I went into these archives looking at this stuff, lo and behold, the archivist came up one day saying, I think we found another box that had been thrown out. And it was his universe on punch cards. So there it is 50 years later, sitting there, sort of suspended animation. That's the instructions for running. This is actually the source code for one of those universes. And with a note from the engineers saying they're having some problems, there must be something about this code that you haven't explained yet. And I think that's really the truth. We still don't understand how these very simple instructions can lead to increasing complexity and what's the dividing line between when that is lifelike and when it really is alive. These cards now, thanks to me showing up, are being saved. And the question is, should we run them or not? They're, you know, could you get that running? Do you want to let it loose on the internet? These machines would think these organisms, if they came back to life now, would have died and gone to heaven. There's a universe. My laptop is 10,000 million times the size of the universe that they lived in when Baricelli quit the project. So he was thinking far ahead how this would really grow into a new kind of life, and that's what's happening. When Juan Enriquez told us about these 12 trillion bits being transferred back and forth of this all this genomics data going to the proteomics lab, that's what Baricelli imagined, that this digital code in these machines is actually starting to code. It already is coding for nucleic acids. We've been doing that since we started PCR and synthesizing small strings of DNA, and real soon we're actually going to be synthesizing the proteins, and like Steve showed us, that just opens a entirely new world. It's a world that von Neumann himself envisioned. This was published after he died, his sort of unfinished notes on self-reproducing machines. What it takes to get the machines sort of jump-started to where they begin to reproduce. It took really three people. I mean, it took Baricelli had the concept of the code as a living thing. Von Neumann saw how you could build the machines that now, their last count, 4 million of these von Neumann machines built every 24 hours. And Julian Bigelow, who died 10 days ago. This is John Markoff's obituary for him. He was the important missing link, the engineer who came in and knew how to put those vacuum tubes together and make it work. And all our computers have inside them the copies of the architecture that he had to just design one day, sort of on pencil and paper. And we owe a tremendous credit to that. And he explained in a very generous way the spirit that brought all these different people to the Institute for Advanced Study in the 40s to do this project and make it freely available with no patents, no restrictions, no intellectual property disputes to the rest of the world. That's the last entry in the logbook when the machine was shut down, July 1958, and it's Julian Bigelow who was running it till midnight when the machine was officially turned off. And that's the end. Thank you very much.
好，可以看出来呢，这一段是讲这个电脑从17世纪开始发展的那一段历史。说起来这个历史哈，托福的段子里边还有雅思的段子里边都有考到，在讲历史课的时候呢，都会引用什么什么多少多少世纪。首先这个第17世纪大概是什么年代啊？是17几几年还是18几几年还是16几几年？
应该是16几几年。
对，
因为我们前几年说我们走进21世纪，那现在我们是2001几年，对吧？
对，
那以此类推，那17世纪就是16几几年。
没错，但是有的同学呢对这事儿老糊涂啊，一听到这个年代的话就脑子里边咯噔一下，心想怎么出来个16几几年，明明是17世纪啊。大家一定在这个年代上先自己有这么一个急转弯的过程。然后呢，他就会讲到了哪一个年代什么人干了哪些事儿，所有历史类的话题大约都是这个架构。那当提到一个人名的时候，一定是这个人在历史上会怎样呢？就是有
一些贡献，
对，有一个影响力，所以他才名垂青史。好，然后呢，再来就是说，在这个技术领域里边的历史哈，还有好多的这个讲座都会讲到什么考古啊，是吧？然后什么一个元素的发现呢？这个其实都是有各种历史。所以呢，在托福的听力里边呢，有介绍过43号元素它的发现过程，然后其中呢提到了两组科学家来自不同的国家，都是发现了这个元素。啊，然后我觉得大家可以有兴趣呢，听我们的节目回放这一段呢，也会在托福的部分讲到。那讲到这个人本身啊，这个研究技术，而且同时跨历史呢，让我想起了一个雅思考试的题目，那就是这个跨学科这件事儿。比如说这个学校应该更重视文科啊，还是更重视理科？大学生应该在什么阶段去选择专业？啊，那你听了这段呢，你就觉得这个 technologies, historians of science, 等等这样的名衔呢，其实在那个 TED Talk 里边有很多，所以呢，这些人都是这个 interdisciplinary experts。
嗯，您刚才提到跨学科，跨学科用英文就是 interdisciplinary。
对，
嗯。
那我们在出国留学的时候呢，我觉得现在新兴的好多学科也都是跨学科，或者是有的学科索性设置成就双学位，比如说既有这个 computer science 又有媒体，像这样的学科呢，大家在出国选择的时候也是不错的。
嗯，
因为复合型人才在新的时代还是很需要的，是吧？嗯，Larry， 你觉得你自己是更偏文科还是更偏理科啊？
我就是您刚才说的媒体加电脑，
对，
这种复合型的人才。因为新媒体现在特别发达，发展的也特别快。我当时在大学学习的时候呢，既学了文科英文，又学了这个电视后期，也算是一个理科，所以是一个文理
对
双学位，
就是有一些个技术性的色彩哈。然后我听到过的专业结合呢比较好的，就是现在有好多的学校，国内的学校也有这种国际部，或者是就是专门为出国来设计的这样的这个院校的部门。所以呢，一方面英文是加强锤炼的，另一方面呢，他们在电子科技啊，乃至于护理护士这样的专业呢，也都是有这个理工科的色彩课程。所以呢，这些同学呢将来以后的就业路子就比较宽啊。 然后如果想自己致力于研究呢，最起码看英文的资料就没有问题。
嗯，我们节目的大部分听众呢都是大学生，他们要么是理科生，要么是文科生。那其实呢，大家可以再关注一下另外那个科，也就是如果你是理科生，可以学一些文科的内容；如果你是文科生，可以学一些理科的内容。这样的话，你可以变成一个复合型人才。
没错。
好，今天的内容就是这一些，感谢大家的收听，欢迎大家加入我们的互动 QQ 群，群号码是3317640，是3317640。那今天节目就这一些，感谢大家收听，也谢谢庄庄老师的陪伴，我们下期节目再见。
再见。I never knew.